Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On the show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we have a special guest from the larger comic book podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. I am super excited for today's guest, who is one of the pillars of the comic book podcasting community. I mean, he's really been doing this as long as anyone and better than most. And he's an incredibly good guy who I had a chance to record with for the first time recently. Welcome to the show, host of the Long Box Review, Eric Isaacson. Eric, how are you doing?
Oh my gosh! My cheeks are flushed, Sean. That was amazing. Thank you for that. I appreciate those thoughts, but boy, I don't know about pillar.
Look, you've been doing. When did you start? Like, you've been doing this. It's like kind of you and Michael Bailey. Like, I mean, you've been in since the beginning.
Well, not quite. I mean, it's only been 15 years, so I haven't quite reached, you know, the status of some of the others whom I would consider pillars, you know. So, I've been around for a little bit, doing my thing.
Yeah, and I love your show. I you and Peter are amazing, and I've recorded with both of you now, which is actually funny. It's kind of a personal bucket list thing. Like, there again, I mean, you're not going to call yourself this, but there are certain pillars of the podcasting community who I've always wanted to record with, and so it's awesome, and I'm so glad you're here. And so before we jump in, Eric, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month. We needed some help running the network and hosting our shows, so we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. Listeners, if you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. So, Eric, we start every episode learning a little bit about the guest's history with Diana F. Themyscira. So, how did you first discover Wonder Woman?
Well, I think, like most people of my age or my generation, you know, it was Super Friends, the cartoon.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I first saw Diana Prince, Wonder Woman, doing super heroic things with everybody else in the Justice League on that show. And then, you know, I'm just, you know, looking back through the mists of time and memory, I seem to recall my next jump is seeing Linda Carter on the eponymous television show. But my first comic book experience with Wonder Woman, because I do my comics history episodes on my show.
Yeah.
So I've been cataloging everything that I started reading with back in 1978. And I believe the very first comic book where I encountered Wonder Woman was Justice League of America, Volume 1, number 168. And this was, I think, the second part of the story where the secret society of supervillains possess several members of the JLA, including Wonder Woman. And so I didn't even really get to see Wonder Woman being Wonder Woman in that very first comic book that I read. So it's a very interesting situation with Diana.
It's so funny how that, I think it's 167, 168, or 168, 169, but either way, those two JLA issues were just a fun Bronze Age two-parter, you know, interesting little story, Secret Society of Supervillains, magic artifact, take over the JLA's bodies, and yet, because of Identity Crisis and the fallout from it, are now so famous that the minute you said the issue number, I was like, yep, I know exactly where he's going. And then in my mind, it also jumps to the great train robbery from the Justice League cartoon where Lex Luthor and Flash swap bodies. Yep. And Lex Luthor takes his mask off in the bathroom and goes, I have no idea who this is. One of the great line deliveries of all time. So that's a great place to start, though, with JLA. Did you collect Wonder Woman at any point, pre-crisis, post-crisis?
Not pre-crisis. It was this series, George Perez being announced as doing Wonder Woman, post-crisis, that I'm like, well, it's George, so I have to read it.
Yeah.
But quite honestly, I never had much of an interest in Wonder Woman, the character, until this series, until this second volume of the comic book. So I I'm so glad I did, because it really made me appreciate the character, the rich history, the mythology that Perez and company brought into it. It was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's funny because, I mean, I feel the same way. I've grown to appreciate pre-crisis Wonder Woman. I did not at the time. I've grown to appreciate it, but it's very much a superhero book. It's pretty straightforward, and you know, even though the mythological figures are interspliced in there, it's different than what Perez, Potter, and Ween and you know, cohorts do in this book, which is so immersive. And this Challenge of the Gods arc is proof of that, because it's answering all these questions set up in issue one of this book, where issue one could have simply been world building. It was instead seed planting. And it's so well done by Perez and the creative team. And it is so immersive that for me, this is the DNA for Diana. Like, this is the blueprint, and everything that follows traces back to this series, but more importantly to George's run on this series. So yeah, same thing. I'm the same place. It's just, you know, and it's funny because recording, I mean, you know, you're doing the, you know, the Legion. I mean, and I love the Baxter series especially. So it's not like there really is no low point in the Baxter series. There are some issues that are more successful than others, but but pound for pound, that is actually that starts off with a bang and ends with a bang.
Yeah,
Rip Magnetic Kid. sorry, spoilers. So yeah, literally starts and ends with death. But that, you know, when you're indexing, when you're doing an index show, the danger of that is losing steam at some point, because maybe the stories aren't as good as you remember, or you're in an arc you don't really love. And I just am constantly amazed by how much I love this series, how much it really is the, you know, what imprinted on me as a kid for Diana and why I love this character to this day. And so it's so much fun. I mean, do you have that same experience as your cataloging Legion, where, you know, even though it's a long run, I mean, it's, you know, 60 issues, you're still kind of finding love in it?
Oh yeah. And I would say, you know, reading Wonder Woman, as I have been with you and your guests.
Oh, thanks.
I know I started, you know, I picked these up when they were first published in the 80s, and I hadn't really looked at them since then. And they, you know, yeah, they'd just been in my long boxes. And then when you announced that you were doing the show, and I started listening to you and your guests talk about these issues, I pulled out my issues and started reading along month by month, until I realized, oh, I probably should read a little bit ahead so I can prepare my notes for for this issue. But yeah, the same with the Legion. It's just like, even though they're, like you say, there, you know, some issues, some stories are more successful than others, there are some little gems.
Yeah.
No matter what's going on, or even at a low point, there is a little gem, whether it's a character moment, mm-hmm, or an action scene, or just, you know, artistic brilliance on the page to appreciate. And we get that in spades, I think, with this Wonder Woman series.
Yeah, yeah, and I love that. You know, even like you said, even in an overall comic issue where you're like, it's okay, there's always a great moment. You know, and that, I think about the, you know, as you're doing the Legion project, I think about the different arcs and eras of that book. You know, the opening with Giffen and Levitz, and then Lytle comes in, and then LaRocque comes in, and then Giffen comes back, and I, you know, there's these fun, these really just fun little moments that I think of so fondly, you know, and the, you know, even in the later issues as they're leading up to the Magic Wars, there's that great issue where Tellus, Magnetic Kid, and Lightning Lass are on a mission, and you're like, oh, these are the new found, like, these are the founders, but they're, you know, they're legacy characters, and all these little things that Levitz did. And Levitz and Perez remind me of each other as writers, because they're rooted in Bronze Age writing, but it doesn't feel archaic or of a time. It's such good storytelling. And in particular, you know, Levitz has the Levitz plot structure, right? The A, B, and C plot. I mean, literally, it's called the Levitz plot structure, and writers use it to this day. And George is similar to Levitz in that it is all about, here's the main story, here are these little seeds, but I'm not going to, you know, Claremontian pay them off in 20 years. No shade to Chris Claremont. I love him. But I'm going to pay them off, you know, within 1 year, and it's all going to feel very, very cohesive. So, yeah, it's fun. It's definitely a style of writing that I miss. I love modern comics. There are so many comics on the shelves right now that are phenomenal. But writers don't necessarily get the same runway to plant the kind of long-term mm-hmm. seeds, because they just don't know how long their book's going to be on the shelves given the nature of the market. So it's a very specific sort of point in time style, but it's really wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. I miss that so much. Like you said, you know, there's some really great comic book stories out there right now. And there are some modern writers and artists that I particularly love. But I still miss this delving into character history and building yeah. characters and maybe not having that runway that Claremont did, but you know, but having this little compact, that payoff that we get in issue 12, mm-hmm. As you said before, where things were set up in issue one, you know, it took a year more or less. Right. But, mm-hmm. but you get some of those things, and then it continues on because of what we discover at the end of this issue, but I won't say any more about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great bit of writing, right? It's I'm going to pay off some things and then launch some new ones. And so,
exactly. Yes.
So perfect segue, because today we're going to be jumping into Wonder Woman volume 2, issue 12, which was released in January of 1988, many, many years ago. The issue, titled Echoes of the Past, is penciled and plotted by George Perez, scripted by Len Wein, inked and finished by Bruce Patterson, lettered by John Costanza, colored by Carl Gafford, and edited by the legendary Karen Berger. Now, Eric, the start of every episode, we go into a segment called Lasso of Truth, where the guest and I each grab Diana's magic lasso and tell some kind of small, fun, or serious, or silly truth about ourselves. So since you are the guest, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. I thought long and hard about whether or not to reveal this about myself, Sean, but given the stature that you hold here, with, especially since you're holding the lasso of truth itself, I feel compelled to go ahead and reveal this little tidbit about my past. I don't know if you know this, Sean, because I've never talked about this on my show, but I became a superhero, and I put that in quotes.
This is all that's in the notes. It just says becoming a superhero. So I'm super excited to hear this whole story.
So, you know, I'm your typical impressionable, this would have been about, I think maybe I'm 12, 11, 12, I don't know. But, you know, I'm reading comic books and I adore the superhero comics that I'm reading, and just, you know, being a superhero, being like Superman, for example, you know, something is so great to aspire to. And then, you know, later, you know, Diana, her in the way that she's portrayed in this series is really inspirational too. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would test this idea out of how to become a superhero. And I've always been a very practical person and looking at things kind of logically. And so I decided I would wear a shirt under my exposed shirt because I wanted to test out how do the superheroes wear their civilian clothes underneath their costume, or vice versa, right?
Vice versa, yeah.
Yeah. And so I did that, and this was in the summer.
Oh no.
And we did not have air conditioning in our house at that time. And so I'm just sweating like crazy, but I keep both shirts on all day long. I didn't have any like, you know, another pair of pants, cause I didn't, you know, all I had were jeans. So I'm not wearing jeans over jeans, but I tried it out with the shirts. And then my parents worked during the day, and they came home, and they were, you know, my brother and sister were talking and all this stuff. But I heard at one point very distinctly my father leaning over to my mother and saying, "Why is he wearing another shirt?" So that was the beginning, Sean. That was awesome. Merely the beginning. And then, you know, this was back in the late 70s, early 80s, right? And so kids back then, we just kind of, at least in where I grew up, you know, we could just go wandering around the neighborhood as long as we were back by dinner time. And so I would tell my mom, "Hey, I'm going to go ride my bike around the neighborhood." And, you know, and that was fine. But really what I was doing, and I didn't tell anybody this until now, Sean, I was patrolling my
that's
neighborhood.
So great. It's so great.
Right? Of course, I'd never, never encountered anything. No, never. But then, okay, fast forward maybe 2 or 3 years. And I have a friend. I won't reveal his identity because he doesn't know I'm talking about this. But we joined up. We formed a crime-fighting duo. And we did go patrolling late one night. We kind of snuck out of, I stayed over at his house. We snuck out of his house about midnight and we're walking around the same town that I'm still doing all this superheroing in. And we even had a run in with the local police.
Oh no. Oh my God. This is awesome. Were they like, what are you kids doing out here and why are you wearing weird clothes?
Well, see, so the good thing was, is one, we were not wearing masks because we couldn't figure out a way. Again, that logical, practical side is, well, how do you make a mask where you can actually see and it's not, you know, plus it's summer, so it's really hot. and we just chose outfits that were more, I'll say, street level gang type.
There you go.
Material instead of That's actually, awesome. You know, like a skin tight suit or anything. Of course, back then they didn't have such things. So anyway, yeah. So the cops did see us. We tried to, you know, casually, quickly walk away, but they're like, no. Get over here. And they start asking us a bunch of questions. What are you guys doing out here? What's going on? And they basically just said, just go home.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, look, we appreciate you patrolling for crime. You are going to be the victims of it if you don't go home. That's
right. Exactly. Exactly.
You will find crime. You're not in the way you think.
And thus ended my career as a superhero.
Oh my God, that is so awesome. That's an awesome story. I love that the cops got involved. That kills me. And then that moment, that's so great. That moment when your dad's like, why is he wearing a shirt on top of a shirt? Because that kids are weird, right? Like kids are just weird, especially at that age. But I think because of the, you know, we grew up pre-internet and even pre-cable TV, like, you know, we had mm-hmm. four channels. I think we had a longer runway for weird back then because we weren't influenced as much by, you know, seeing the same, you know, videos everybody's seeing or same shows right. everybody's seeing. And so I love this like moment where, I mean, and every parent has it. I've certainly had it with my kid. Every parent has a moment where you look at your kid and you go, I'm not even going to ask. Like, you know, like it's not doing any damage. It doesn't have me worried about their present or future. But I also just don't want to know. So I'm just gonna walk through the room and pretend I don't see you wearing multiple layers of clothes in the summer. You know, and yeah. Oh my God, that's yes. awesome. That's yeah, awesome. Same. It's awesome. I think a lot of us have stories like this because Shag was on an episode a while ago, and we both had stories of like he would cut Dixie cups and make them like Wonder Woman's bracelets, and I would pull.
That's little, awesome.
Yeah, I would grab like the tubes out of paper towels, and I would make like battle staves, like Mockingbird. I mean, so you know, it's that's pretty awesome. Oh my God, that's so great. So it's my turn to grab the lasso. Mine is going to be much less heroic, but I am a huge supporter of charities that are out to research and hopefully one day cure diabetes. And I have a very specific origin as to why I support diabetes research beyond the fact that it's a great thing to support and millions suffer with diabetes and it's an important disease that I hope we cure. There's a reason I support it a little bit more. And that is because my middle sister has type 1 diabetes and she's had it for 45 years. So she is 6 years older than me. She was diagnosed in the 80s and it was still a relatively new disease at that time. I mean, doctors knew what it was, but they were still using like pig insulin and people were, you know, dosing from syringes. They didn't have the awesome little machines and watches and all the things that they have today to help them. It was the early days of the disease. And so my poor sister used to have to dose herself with insulin multiple times a day. So she always had syringes on her. And I, you know, as her little brother, I was very used to this and actually didn't think anything of it if when I would just see her giving herself an insulin dose. So one day, as is my job as the little brother, I was bugging her because she was in her bedroom on the phone and I knew she was talking to a boy. So I kept like running into the room, singing a little song or making kissing noises and then running out and then running. And the more annoyed she got, the happier it was making me. But she couldn't say anything, right? Because she was like on the phone and this is a cord, you know, it's a phone with a cord. This is the 80s. So she couldn't move very far. And she really couldn't reach me, and I knew she couldn't reach me. She was like a tiger in a cage, and I was just more and more. I mean, it was making me happier and happier the more she was frustrated, but couldn't act frustrated because she was trying to play it cool with this boy on the phone. So she's also reading a magazine, kind of flipping through it in front of her, and she's starting to dose herself while she's on the phone. So I'm running in, she's waving me off. I run out, I run in, she's waving me off. Well, at one point I run in for the last time because she knows I'm coming. So she apparently, while talking to this boy, thinks, oh, I'm just going to throw my magazine at this idiot and, you know, get him out of my room. But she doesn't use the correct hand and instead takes the open syringe she was about to dose herself with and chucks it at me like freaking Gambit throwing a playing card. I mean, my sister missed her calling as like a knife thrower in the circus because that thing flew across the room and hit me right in the shoulder and stuck. And now,
oh my God.
Anybody who's knows diabetic, these aren't large syringes. They're not large needles. So this was kind of a one in a million shot. But I look down and I'm like, oh my God. And there's just this syringe sticking out of my arm. And she goes, oh my God. And hangs up on the boy and comes running over, pulls the syringe out. I'm crying. I'm not in any pain at all. It's just the shock of it. But I'm crying. You stabbed me. I can't believe you stabbed me. And then I'm like, I didn't know if there was insulin in there. And I didn't really even understand what insulin was or did. So I'm like, am I going to die? Did you? And she's like, no, you idiot. I hadn't even done the insulin yet. You're not going to die. Plus your body produces insulin. And so I was like making such a ruckus and no one was home. Again, the 80s, no one was raising us. But as she calmed me down, she very wisely realized that she was going to have to bribe me. And so I proceeded to basically blackmail her for a week into doing whatever I wanted in order to not report that she had stabbed me with it. It actually chucked a open syringe at me and stabbed me. So I want to reiterate my call to the listeners to support diabetes research and to help cure this disease, not only yeah. because it would help millions of people, but it would also help millions of little brothers keep from getting stabbed by their crazy circus knife-throwing sisters chucking syringes. So that's my call to charity.
Sean, I think you and your sister missed your calling as a supervillain duo.
Oh, my God, right? I mean, look, if Diamondback could be a villain in the 80s throwing fake diamonds, my sister could have been like the diabetic, you know? I could have been like Sharp's Container, her sidekick or something. I don't, you know? It's so funny. To this day, I have this visceral memory of looking at my arm with the syringe sticking out and just panicking. And yeah, and it's actually shocking because I'm not afraid of needles. When I give blood or I donate or I get my blood tested, I don't look at the needle going in, but I'm not like nervous or anything. I'm you know, kind of fine. And I don't know if it's because she stabbed me or, you know, or what, but yeah, that could have gone a couple different directions, but it's
so funny. So did your parents ever find out?
No, I was a good little brother. I'm 6 and my oldest sister is 7 years older than me. My middle sister is 6. So they were great. I mean, they were effectively de facto parents to me. So at a certain point, we all teamed up together against our parents.
Yeah.
And I would cover for them, but they knew they had to buy my silence. And so it was a good – I mean, there is literally a chunk of my comic book collection that is bribery related from my sisters buying me off with comics because of they went out with a boy and came back later than they're supposed to, or, you know, progressively, or the school used to call when my sisters would ditch. And I would answer the phone and I would be like, I'll tell my parents. Okay. And then I would never tell my parents. So depending on the level of crime or sin, that was how many comics I got. So yeah, I've got there's a whole long box or more of bribery comics. I should start a show actually.
I was going to say,
I should start a show called Bribery Comics.
That's great. I'm sure you're not alone in the comic book community.
There's no way. That's got to be a story so many people have. Either that or Shut Up, the Adults Are Talking comics.
Yeah, like, yes. Yeah. 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 Those are the ones that I sometimes got.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We all did. And those were great. It's a great. I mean, I'll happily shut up if you give me – to this day, as an adult, if you give me a comic, I will happily shut up.
Oh, I'm going to use that with my wife.
Yeah. Basically, hey, there's an easy way to bribe me. So that takes us from the Lasso of Truth to the comic. I'm going to provide a brief summary of the issue, and then we'll jump in full bore. So Issue 12 of Wonder Woman Volume 2 is part 3 of Challenge of the Gods, and we find our Diana, and that's an important distinction, meeting and learning the origin of her namesake, Diana Trevor. And that should be raising your ears a little bit, that last name. And yep, that's right, Steve Trevor's mother actually landed on Paradise Island many years ago, saw the Hundred-Handed One trying to escape the Hellmouth below Paradise Island, and gave her life to protect women who she had never met. Meanwhile, Steve thinks of his mother while burying his father, and his father and mother are going to reunite in the afterlife, which is a lovely little moment we'll talk about. And then the action of the issue really comes in the form of Hippolyta, Diana's just badass mom, who is delving the depths of the Hellmouth, fighting harpies and hydra skeletons and all other sort of creatures trying to get to her daughter, only to discover the imprisoned, altered form of Heracles, the man who attacked her and her sisters many, many years ago. So talk about a jumping off point for the end of the issue. But before we get to the end of the issue, let's start with the beginning and talk about the cover. Eric, why don't you describe the cover for the listeners and tell us your thoughts?
Okay, so we have what looks like Diana on the cover. And if, you know, when I could guess my younger self reading this going, oh, why is Wonder Woman holding a pistol? And so we see an Amazon clad warrior person pointing a gun at us, at the audience. But what we see coming around the edges of this are these many, many dark hands. And she's illuminated by some, you know, beautiful reds and oranges, like almost like there's a fire illuminating this, maybe a cave or the side of a hill or something. And then, of course, unfortunately, we also have the Millennium Week One logo above.
Unfortunate for so many reasons.
Yeah, cluttering up the wonderful drawing that we have here. But it's just a gorgeous George Perez cover that really screams, you got to open me and find out what the heck's going on here.
Yeah, it is strikingly powerful. The and again, just like last month, we give a huge shout out to Carl Gafford / Tatiana Wood. We're not 100% sure which of the two of them colored the cover, but last month it was this sickly green that indicated Diana had, you know, was deep into this Hellmouth and was facing evil. And this time that burnt orange casting the shadows, while the depth, the really inky black of the Hundred Hands coming at Diana, and the striking bit where you center on the gun. I mean, the coloring is doing so much work, but also it's just a beautifully composed cover. You have Perez eyes. I mean, there's no eyes like Perez eyes, right?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you see those eyes that, you know, frightened but resolute, staring directly at you, pointing the gun directly at you. And it's so incongruous because the assumption is, oh, this is Diana of Themyscira. This is our Diana. It's actually an interesting sort of merging of the two Dianas, because really this is Diana Trevor's moment from the story, but definitely this is meant to look like our Diana.
Mm.
And I think it's Perez merging the two of them in preparation thematically for the coming together of their stories in this issue. But it's such an incongruous thing to see Wonder Woman frightened and pointing a gun that it's like, oh no, I have to own this. You know, even with the Millennium Banner, I have to buy it. I have to open it. You know, and it's one of my favorite covers from this arc, and it's one of my favorite covers from the run because of the merging of pencil and coloring art. I just think it's a perfect example of why the color artist is often just as important as the penciler and the ink.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such a good cover. And one of the things that's challenging in this show is I'm always going to wax, you know, the guests and I are always going to wax Perez's car. But there are just times where it's like, yep, this is, you know, for some artists, if they drew this cover, it'd be the greatest thing they ever drew. And for Perez, it's still a great one. And it kind of does echo. Tim Price had made a really interesting comment on last episode in the feedback, talking about how there's a through line in this book of Diana being sort of consistently overwhelmed by forces like hands or chains or snakes. And Tim had said, hey, you know, there might be sort of a sexual or kinky undercurrent there, which is absolutely possible. And I had said back in the feedback, I think, you know, that is definitely a read, and it's not an invalid read at all. But there's also, if you go back to the origins of Wonder Woman, you know, William Moulton Marston, his aunt through marriage was Margaret Sanger, the great women's activist, suffragette, birth control activist. And Margaret Sanger used to say, you know, women are chained by forced matrimony and motherhood, that basically not giving women choice via birth control or the vote or other options chains them. And so H.G. Peter in early Wonder Woman comics used to always draw Wonder Woman chained, but then he would always draw her busting those chains. And so I like to think Perez is playing on that a little bit too, but it is just an interesting motif that's always coming at you.
Mm-hmm. And I would add too, you know, it's also about Diana and this in this reimagining of the character that we've gotten since issue one, where she is a devotee to the gods.
Yeah.
And that starts to change here. And so, yes, she's assaulted in many different ways, you know, on the page. But, you know, to me, from a character development standpoint, it's also about that, the patronage that the Amazons show the gods, that Diana in particular, and probably Hippolyta as well. But, you know, that starts to change here.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is fascinating because here they've been raised and have always been bestowed with gifts by the gods. And now it's like, oof, okay, wait a minute. In a way, our direct enemy in this arc, you know, or at least the MacGuffin for the arc, is Zeus. And it's truly a challenge of the gods. It's a challenge to keep worshiping them if this is the way they're going to mm-hmm. behave. And so I love the transition here, because as we open the issue, we open on Hippolyta descending down into the Hellmouth and having these flying creatures attacking her. And she comes up with a brilliant strategy, because it's pitch black in there. Her sword arm's not going to be enough. So she pours some oil that she brought with her for torches into the reverse base of her shield, which is convex, lights it on fire, causing a huge sort of, you know, eruption of flame to blind and frighten these creatures. And Hippolyta is really the action star of this issue in particular, and kind of secondarily to this arc. And what are your thoughts about this spotlight on Diana's mom?
Well, again, I didn't have much experience with her mother in other comic books before this. So this was really my introduction to Diana's mother, reading these issues. And so seeing her, especially in these last two issues, 11 and 12, you know, doing what she's doing, you know, taking on the action hero part.
Yeah.
It was just a delight to see the Queen of the Amazons, this very dignified and strict, you know, in a sense, woman, because she's the leader of this people, and her daughter's out there combating Ares and whatnot. That she is doing, you know, she basically steps away from that role,
yeah,
and back into. I shouldn't say back into, because she's always Diana's mother, but in that more protective, in I'll just say traditional maternal definition, role of mother, and not just, you know, Diana, let me help you. She's active and actiony, and she's brilliant too, because that whole shield thing, you know, I just would have been just kept hacking and slashing and died,
yeah,
if I were. But, you know, it occurred to me that this is even pardon me for my stretches here, Sean, but it's almost like a mirror image, if you will, of what who was it, Theseus who battled the Gorgon and
yeah.
used the reflection of a shield to
yep.
to defeat her, yeah, or to help defeat her, yeah. And it's, you know, so it's things like that that I really appreciate, even if I'm really digging here. But
I actually think the illusion is there. I think it's any time you're using a shield to defeat a magical creature, that's going to be a place your mind goes. So no, I think it's definitely there. And then also the ingenuity of, you know, in a different creative team's hands, she's descending, she's attacked, she would hack and slash. Like I haven't played video games in quite a while, but when I used to play, I was what was lovingly referred to as a button masher. Like I would just keep hitting the button and attacking and praying that whatever I was doing was working. And instead of button mashing, you know, you're reminded of like, oh, Hippolyta's not just queen of the Amazons because she sprung out of the water first. She's queen of the Amazons because she is the baddest woman on the block. You know, like no one's messing with her. So I love that element too.
Yeah.
So this is really the and there's a reason Perez and Ween open on this Hippolyta moment, because the through line of this book and what we will come to understand as a through line of this challenge is parenthood, is about legacy and parenthood, who our parents were as people, who they were as parents, and then who are we in light of that of those answers to those questions. And we transition really beautifully to Steve Trevor. We go from one hellmouth to another. We go from the hellmouth under Paradise Island to Oklahoma. Sorry, that was for the host, the co-host of last episode, Clinton Robinson. Sorry, Clinton. So we go to Oklahoma, and Steve is sitting at his father's side. His father has passed. Steve didn't make it back home in time before his father passed away. And Steve is Perez and Ween give really nice real estate to this. It's only a page, but it's a George Perez page. There's a million panels on it. And Steve is just reminiscing about these, basically his dad raising him on his own for most of his life, and we'll learn why, and these fishing trips they went on, and what a good man his father was, and what a good relationship they had. And it actually brings me to my first secret question of the episode.
Oh, no.
And this one's personal, and I hope it's okay to ask this. Like, do you have a beloved or favorite memory you'd be willing to share of a time with your father?
Considering that my father passed earlier this year.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I have had a lot of been reminiscing a lot.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that's coming to me at the moment, Sean, is within the last year before he died, I would go and spend time with him. And he started telling me stories about things he did when he was younger.
Yeah.
And he never told us as we were growing up any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very private person. And so whenever he would just share a story, you know, for example, the time that he was helping a person move, and he was driving the truck full of this person's belongings, and he apparently got confused and went to a different place that was called this, I forget the name of the place now. And so he ended up dozens, if not 100 miles away from where he was supposed to be. And the person assumed that my father just stole all of
it. Oh, no.
And so this person had called the cops.
Oh, my God.
And I believe, if I remember correctly, my dad said that the cops actually did pull him over.
Oh, wow. That's because there was a great story.
Yeah. And so it's just, you know, things like that. And just anything that he would share with me like that I honestly wish now that I had brought my recording device. And every time we talked, I had recorded those little stories.
Isn't it fascinating how, as our parents age, that I think that is a natural function of age. It's almost like they can see the end, and as part of the process of seeing that end coming, they want you, or they want those they love, to know them more fully, right? More as people, and you know, less as the role they played in your life. Though that's obviously very important as well. So they will share those funny stories, and they will, you know, tell those little moments where you're like, oh my God. And it helps you see them as people. It helps you see my father passed quite a while ago. My mom is aging and definitely in that run right now where when we're together and I see her quite often. My sister and I are kind of her primary caregivers. When I see her, quite often it's, you know, she is leaning into some story or talking about something. We'll talk about something, it'll remind her of something from her past. And I really do cherish those moments because it does open up a new window. And so I asked the question about a memory with your dad. This one's a little tricky for me because I've talked about this a bit before in this podcast or other podcasts, but I had a very tumultuous relationship with my father. He was not a good man and had some substance abuse issues. And so for the majority of my life, his absence was a good thing. But I do remember a couple of times early in my life where he was trying to make some attempts to sort of connect. And this was very much my father. He just shows up to my school one day. I think I was literally in like second or third grade. And he just pulls me out of school, doesn't tell my mom, doesn't, you know, say anything, and just randomly takes me to like a bowling alley. We go bowling. We go to a store. I had just gotten an Atari for the first time. He goes and he buys me an Atari game, which I was like, oh my God, I was super excited. I think I had Pinball and Combat. So getting a new, you know, Atari game was a big deal. And, you know, we kind of spent this time together, and then he drops me off at home. And now one of the memories of dropping me off was my mom coming out screaming, like, where the hell were you? Why didn't you tell me you were doing that? Like, you know, there was that piece of it, but I choose to remember the other piece, which was this really fun kind of sweet day, you know, where he just, I don't know what prompted it. I don't know why, but it was this sweet moment where, you know, he wanted to kind of step in and, you know, be fatherly. And I remember that moment very vividly because I loved comics. And one of the, he took me to the local 7-Eleven. I was able to pick a few comics and I bought Thing number 10, which is the issue where the Thing is taken to Secret Wars. He and Alicia are sort of, he's walking through Central Park. He's reminiscing on his and Alicia's relationship has kind of ended or ending. And then he and Reed and Johnny, there's one of Reed's devices goes off and they find the Beyonder ship and they go in and they get kidnapped to Secret Wars. So it was this vivid memory of mine because I was like, oh, what is this Secret Wars thing? This is going to be amazing. So so it's nice. And as I've gotten older, you know, and again, he passed 20 plus years ago. As I've gotten older and, you know, as a father and I've kind of processed my relationship with him, I have found myself trying to unearth those moments more, you know, trying to sift through the dirt to get to those little gold nuggets. And so, and there are some there, you know, and I want to like retroactively in my mind, I want to give him credit for those little moments. And, you know, there are a million things I could say about there not being enough or I shouldn't have to do that much work. But at the end of the day, why is that serving me? I'm just, you know, going to look for those tiny moments. And I think it's this issue hit me in that sort of, you know, reflective pocket with Steve thinking about his dad, and then that thinking about his dad transitioning to this revelation, because Etta Candy is with Steve and she's looking at a picture of Steve's mom, who's young and beautiful because she passed when she was really young. And she's like, wow, gosh, his mom is so pretty, but he never talks about her. What was her name? And the aunt says Diana, and then it cuts to our Diana with Diana Trevor saying, wait, your name's Diana? And it's a really cute little, I mean, it's a great quick edit, right? Like it'd be a great edit in a TV show. They do such a good job.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This is one of my favorite things about this issue are these transitions.
Yeah.
And this would be like a quick cut. Yeah. In television, right, or film. But there are other transitions that they do, and I'll talk about one of those in particular down the road. But yeah, I love that idea of Diana's name being said, and then it's Diana saying Diana's name, and then we see her namesake.
Yeah, it's like an abundance of Dianas. And it's so awesome because she's there, the Diana we don't know, Diana Trevor, is there. And our Diana doesn't know she's Diana Trevor yet. But Diana Trevor is there saying basically like, hey, one of the reasons you're on this quest, this challenge of the gods, is to learn not, you know, more about your past and your unique connection to, you know, me and to my family. And so we get the origin of Diana Trevor. Do you want to do a little recap of that?
Yeah. So she, growing up, as she says here, what does it say? While other girls my age wanted to be wives and mothers, I wanted to be airborne. Mm-hmm. Ever since I saw the movie Wings when I was 7, I knew that was my destiny. And by the way, Sean, I did look this up. You know, when was the movie Wings put out? And I think it was 1927. And so that means she was born in 1920. And she, extrapolating the dates from there, that means she was 20 when her son Steve was born, if I've got that right.
Which at that time, you know, makes sense. People got married sort of younger, especially wartime. And then I think that means she's what, about 28 when she dies?
Yes, I believe that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Around there. Yeah. Anyway, so she took that love of her desire to fly to become a barnstormer, which I thought was a great addition, a detail of this character, you know, forging her own path as a woman mm-hmm. in a time where women weren't supposed to do those sorts of things.
No. And also, speaking of Atari, one of the great Atari games, Barnstormer, was a classic.
Your talk of Atari just makes me wistful for those long ago times, and but also for Atari, because I didn't have an Atari. I didn't get to play that stuff.
Oh my gosh, I had Atari. My best friend had Activision, so between us, we had everything covered. It was the best.
Oh my gosh. Speaking of my father, this is one of those things. You can cut it out if you want.
No.
He came home, and one of those unexpected surprises, he came home one day with a ColecoVision.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, look, it's not Atari or Activision, but it is. Nope. ColecoVision had great games, and that's a sweet thing, because you know all he thought was video, whatever this video game thing is, kids are into it. I'll get this for my kids. And yeah, one of those great dad stories where you're trying really hard to do the right thing, and your kids are like, oh, ColecoVision, you know, like Betamax, really? Like,
right, exactly. Anyway, so during one of those Barnstormer sessions, Diana met a young lieutenant, Ulysses. Oh, I've forgotten his middle name.
Steve. So
it is Steve. Okay.
He's U.S. Trevor, which is a little on the nose.
Yes, right. Of course, they get married, and then the war starts, and Steve is born. She joins, what did she say, the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron. And I love the panel where she says, of course, the enemy couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And probably didn't care if it was a woman flying those planes. So we were frequently used for target practice.
It's a nice little touch. You can tell Ween and Perez did their research, and it's a nice little touch. And I like the sarcasm, because she's brassy, right? She's like mm-hmm. She's not demure. She's no shrinking violet. So, you know, anybody who's a barnstormer and a pilot at a young age as a woman at that time is going to have, you know, some guts. And I love the little shot at, like, and, you know, the men didn't mind us being the target. You know, it's just a nice – it feels like a Claremont dame. It feels like, you know, early Carol Danvers or Madeline Pryor or something. So I love it. I love how, you know, she's got a little attitude, which is nice.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, the war ends, and she goes home to be a mother – and wife. And do we want to end it there as far as her background?
Yeah, we'll come back to it in a second. That's what Diana learns thus far.
Right.
And again, we know this is Diana Trevor, but our Diana does not. So again, these really nice cuts between Hippolyta, and then we get to Steve, and then we get to the Dianas. Now we're going to do go ahead.
Before we move on from that, Sean, this comes to my first secret question for you.
Yes.
So, given now, granted, your last episode for issue 11, you had that great ending of the issue with the reveal of what is Diana Trevor mm-hmm. in her star-spangled glory, right?
Yep.
And so we see a little bit of that. It's not quite as pronounced in this scene with our Diana, but she is dressed in a Wonder Woman-like costume, I'll say. Mm-hmm. So my first secret question for you is, who is your favorite, other than maybe Wonder Woman, who's your favorite, but who had the best star-spangled costume?
Oh, that is a good question. I was wondering where you were going, because when you were like, who's your favorite? I was like, is he going to ask me my favorite Diana? I was like, I don't limit something like, does Diane from Cheers count? Like, I don't... That's such a good question. I'm gonna thinking out loud. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I love Wonder Woman's costume, but I've always been a sucker for Uncle Sam, that character. In
oh yes,
mm-hmm. from the Freedom Fighters.
That's a great choice.
Definitely, Stargirl, who's one of my favorite mm-hmm. characters, jumps out.
Right,
but what I think of as the most interesting use of a patriotic motif. In not only in costume, but also in character, is – do you remember Citizen V from the Thunderbolts?
Oh, right.
It was Baron Zemo's heroic alias when the Thunderbolts were tricking the world into thinking they were heroes after heroes were born – or heroes whatever, Onslaught, after all the heroes are supposedly dead. Citizen V is Baron Zemo, and it's this patriotic costume with a lot of flourish and flair. He had a sword, and it had like the stars on one shoulder and like the stripes on the other. And it was really interesting because it was a patriotic themed costume, but Mark Bagley was the artist. Bagley was brilliant in that it was, if you looked at it from a certain angle, kind of a fascist version of a patriotic costume. It felt a little stormtroopery. It felt a little and you didn't think that in when you're reading Thunderbolts 1, because you think they're heroes until you get to the last page and you understand it's Baron Zemo. So really just a brilliant character design. So I've always – Bagley deserves a ton of credit for that design. That's this is such a good question. What about you?
Well, boy, now I feel really dumb for
– No.
Because I immediately jumped to Star Spangled Kid.
Oh, no. That's a great choice.
You know, that costume is just so – it's too much. But yeah. I love it. It just totally works, you know. And his later Skyman was it?
Yeah,
it wasn't quite as good, but no. But I like that. And my secondary one would be Miss Liberty. But then as I was looking at them,
yeah,
the two of them, I'm like, oh, they're basically the same thing. Just yeah, you know, the cut of the cloth is a little different.
It's so funny too because I have a real love for the Star Spangled Kid costume as a piece of a time, you know, like a relic from the 40s. Like, it's not a costume I think anybody would try to wear today, but I love it. No. I love it from like that World War II setting. And then interestingly, I hate that character. Considering the small number of appearances Sylvester Pemberton ever made and my limited encounters with him through like All-Star comics and the relaunch of the JLA and the JSA, excuse me, in the late 70s, Infinity Inc., you know, where he got sort of most of his play in my collecting history, I always found him so obnoxious. And part of it was because Roy Thomas made him just so cocky and mm-hmm. arrogant. And I was like, you don't like, and your power set's lame. Like, what are you, you know, like, I never liked him. So it's funny because my hatred of Sylvester Pemberton inversely is indicative of my love of Courtney Whitmore. Like, I love Stargirl. Mm-hmm. So I just, that's a great question. Oh my God, there's so many good and so many bad, really bad patriotic costumes too.
Yeah.
That's a good one. So we cut from the Dianas to Pan, who with a Millennium Banner, you know, we now know, and it hasn't been confirmed, but it's going to be that he is a Manhunter, though how he slips that past the gods is kind of a question.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, really? The gods couldn't tell there was something maybe oddly metallic about this guy?
So I had that in my notes as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an oversight. And so he is trying to stop Hippolyta and Diana. So he goes to where the Hydra's skeleton is because Diana defeated the Hydra and basically buried him in fire and lava. And he works some Manhunter magic to make the skeletal pieces rise from the ground, which I love because I'm a huge Evil Dead fan. Did you like those movies?
I've actually only seen the first one. So
okay.
So a huge gap in my geekdom history.
I mean, they're such awesomely – it's Sam Raimi, interestingly, as the director. I always forget it's Sam Raimi. But they're such great – movies. They're these, you know, silly spoofs on horror movies. They're super low budget and it's, you know, very purposely tongue in cheek, and they get more tongue in cheek as they go, in particular, sort of culminating with, and you know, Bruce Campbell as Ash as the main character. And Bruce Campbell's just one of the great comic actors of all time.
Oh yeah.
Culminating in Army of Darkness, where he's sent back to the past and has to get the Necronomicon. It's Army of Darkness is one of my favorite movies ever. It's a movie that I'd already kind of watched Evil Dead, but I had missed Army of Darkness for some reason. So I caught it on video in like maybe my freshman or sophomore year of college. And it was our go-to late night drunk movie where whenever friends and I were hanging out or crashing at somebody's dorm, somebody would pop Army of Darkness in and we would just be uttering the lines the whole movie. And so this felt like such a great low budget Army of Darkness fight with these skeletons rising with weapons from somewhere. I don't know where the weapons came from. And Hippolyta facing off against them. So again, a maternal moment though, because she's there to protect Diana. And we cut to Steve again. And this time he's reminiscing about his mom. He's with Etta, and they're building this really nice little relationship between Steve and Etta that I really like. And as shocking as the changes in the structure of Diana's supporting cast with Steve and Etta pre to post crisis, it is actually still, it's a really nice little bit of world building to have them forming this relationship. And so Steve now is looking at pictures of his mom, and there aren't many of them because she wasn't alive for much of his life. And he's sort of talking about how who she was and how she left. And so this is going to bring me to a very natural next secret question. Do you have a favorite or beloved memory that you'd be willing to share of you and your mom, or of your mom?
Yeah, there's... So my parents owned a restaurant for a while.
Oh, cool.
And it was named after my mother. It was called Debbie's Country Kitchen. And I worked there as for a bit. And I only bring this up because it's just really a silly thing. But there was one time we were just kind of goofing around. You know, my mom was making pies. That was kind of her big thing at the restaurant. And I don't remember what I was doing. I was maybe doing some dishes or something. I don't recall now. But we were kind of giving each other crap back and forth. And then next thing I know, she comes at me with a little bit of or a little handful of whipped cream from the pies that she's making. And she, I don't know if she was trying to just rub it on my face or whatever, but I moved anyway. She got this heavy, thick whipped cream stuffed in my ear.
That's awesome.
And at the time I was like really mad because I don't like things on me. If it's messy, I don't like to deal with it, you know. Anyway, so I had this stuff and I could not get it all out.
And it was probably that thick, like schlag, right? Like that dirt, like heavy whipping cream that I can actually feel that. Like, can you still to this day feel it in your ear?
When I think about it, oh yeah, I'm like, what? And quite honestly, I was a little mad at her at the moment, but then looking back on it later, I'm like, oh, that was such a cute out of character thing for my mom to do to me. So I miss that kind of stuff.
That is really sweet. Cause you know, I mean, and I have these moments too with my kiddo. There are just moments where you're doing something and you know, the day is about like, oh, I have to get this task done and we have to get this and you just look over and you're like, I just want to throw something at them right now. Like, but in a fun way, like in a loving way. Like, I just want to, you know, I want to be goofy right now. And that's a sweet memory. That's awesome. So do you watch Bob Burgers, and is it an accurate portrayal of a family living who has a restaurant? Or are you like, no, this is not how it is?
Unfortunately, I've only seen very, very few episodes of Bob's Burgers, but, from what I can recall, the relationship type stuff of those things that I've seen, it seems somewhat realistic in terms of working together.
Yeah, I love that show. I think it's hilarious. Plus, my wife and my kid love it, so it's a nice little family show we watch. I mean, it's not a family show in the traditional sense, but it's great. Mm-hmm. So that's awesome. That's a great memory. I have one. My family with my parents, the tumultuous nature of their marriage, we tended to move around a lot to, like, my mom was a single mom and we'd move a bunch to apartments, you know, that she could afford or, you know, depending on things, you know, like that. So we just moved so often when I was a kid that I was always starting new schools. And I was always starting new schools at weird times. You know, like I was the new kid in March, which is a crappy time to be the new kid, you know, after almost the whole school year's done, those kinds of things. And so one move in particular, I was probably like 11, was especially hard because I had really loved my previous school. I had really good friends. And I was just kind of devastated to leave. And I wasn't making new friends at my new school. And I was really struggling. And she just must have sensed it, you know, without kind of delving too deeply into it. And so out of the blue, she was like, hey, you know what? Let's get out of here. And it was like a Saturday and it was just me and her. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And I thought she meant like, let's go to the mall or let's, you know. So we just get in the car and she drives all the way to Sedona, Arizona. So Sedona's about a 2.5 hour drive north of Phoenix, 2 hour, depending on traffic, 2 hour, 2.5 hour. Sedona, Arizona is one of those beautiful places on the planet. I mean, it is people fly from all over the world. I got married in Sedona. It is just, it's these red rocks and red clay, and it's also supposed to be this very spiritual, you know, place. So there's a lot of women with crystals who make their own soap, and, you know, like those kinds of things happening there. And we just drove to Sedona, and we like walked around the whole day, and we got food, and we, you know, I got, you know, typical kid, I found a place that sold comics. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to buy comics in Sedona. That's neat. You know, and I, you know, that just, and just, I remember that day. And then we drove back so vividly because it was this like really sweet moment of her just saying, you know, here she was working multiple jobs to support three kids and all this, all the things that were on top of her, you know, her responsibilities. And she just looked at me and was like, he's sad. And I think this would cheer him up. And I just, I don't, I, it's so funny because I just think about that day a lot, especially as she's getting older. And I think about that kindness. And sometimes I need to, because as anybody who cares for their elderly parents knows, there are days where it's really hard to go over and help them. There are days where you've got the energy, and there are days where you're like, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is explain to you for the 50th time how Netflix works. And so I have to channel that day sometimes. You're like, just remember, just remember. So we get the rest of much more of the origin of Diana Trevor. So do you want to advance that story? Tell us what happens there.
Yeah. So she, even though that, you know, spending time with young Steve, she still has a passion for flying. And so she has an opportunity to deliver, I think it is, a new Sabre jet that was it the Air Force or the Army that wanted? And it is, so she has this little conversation about with Steve, saying that even though she'll miss his birthday, she'll be home for Christmas. And as she says here, I guess he didn't really believe he'd see me for Christmas. Poor baby, I still wonder how he knew. Mm. And then she's flying the Sabre, and then she encounters a lightning storm and ends up having to bail out of her plane and then plunges into the sea.
And it's so reminiscent of issue two of this series. It's basically the Steve Trevor flight over Paradise Island, you know, but 40, you know, plus years earlier. So we're getting the visual cues. The smoke's the same. The lightning's the same. We're getting the visual cues here. You know, again and again, of like this tying together of these stories in a way that's interesting, and it's going to, I think, for both of us, going to bring up some questions later. So we cut back from one mom to another. We cut back to Hippolyta in a panel I love. Again, pure Ash Army of Darkness. Hippolyta's got an axe and chops the head off of one of the skeleton zombies, and you can almost hear him screaming as he flies off screen. It's such a great little bit of art.
Well, and the skull is really, you know, close to us, you know, in the panel, right? So it's like if this were a 3D comic, you would see that coming right at you.
Yeah, this is like the Captain EO moment of this comic, guys. Yeah, definitely just flying off the page. And Hippolyta fights bravely, and she almost perishes, but she's able to defeat the skeletons because she's, again, amazing. And she walks to the two tunnels. We saw this moment previously with Diana, where she has to pick two paths, and Diana picks the one where she learns about the souls of the Amazons who fell protecting the Hellmouth, keeping it closed. And Hippolyta is confronted by – this is such an interesting piece of art. It's almost like the human centipede but made of tragedy masks. You know, the comedy and tragedy theater masks?
Yes.
I mean, it's almost how I would describe it. It's compelling in that it convey – in a non-audio medium in a comic book, it conveys – really well that they're wailing, and the wailing of their like loneliness and sadness is just crushing Hippolyta. Like, dude, what did you think of this particular moment?
It actually reminded me of something that I had read before. Unfortunately, I can't recall what it is. Maybe I've just encountered this idea or this imagery in something else, but it was a really, I thought, really well done in terms of how we see her reacting. We don't actually, there's nothing on the panels. There's no sound effect, of this pillar, but you see the consequence of what they're doing or what doing. I don't know. Or just their being.
Yeah.
it's being, I'm not quite sure. So I really like how we see Hippolyta reacting to this, and it is devastating. And it's only because of the interference of the vulture that she's able to get through that challenge, if you will.
Yeah, the vulture is interesting, right? Because in the last issue, it appeared at her window, and it kind of prompted her to make the decision to abandon her role as queen and instead be a mom and go help Diana. Now it appears again. It doesn't help in any fights, but now it appears again. And the text is so interesting because it's not that the vulture like stops the wailing, uses powers or even words. It just says it looks at the wailing pillar compassionately, as if it understands its pain. And just that brief moment of understanding gets the faces to stop screaming. And I was like, that's a George Perez Wonder Woman moment. Mm-hmm. Instead of power stops them, might makes right, it's compassion. It's a moment of kindness that saves the day. And I was like, that's pure George Perez. But and now the vulture is interesting. I know you have some ideas, right, about the vulture?
Well, yeah, it just conjured in me these questions about, well, who's behind the vulture? Because, you know, obviously it's not just a vulture, right? We are talking about a story about gods and mythology. But I did a little bit of research and I found in mythology, sometimes vultures were guides to help navigate the passage from life to death.
That's awesome.
And that, you know, if that's the case, if we accept that as an option here, you know, the vulture providing that moment of compassion that calms the pillar of power, that just, I think, just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that idea, I love that idea that the vulture is the guide between the living and the dead, because it makes sense. That's the bird we associate with death because it feeds off of carrion and, you know, it literally exists off the dead. And it's a really powerful metaphor. And yet in modern culture, a vulture is a negative thing, right? It's Adrian Toomes beating Spider-Man. You know, it's it's not a positive thing. And we don't necessarily see vulture as a good thing. But to the Greeks, the afterlife wasn't a bad thing. It was inevitable. It just was. And sure, if you were a great warrior, you could try for Elysium. Or if you were a horrible person who like ate their own children, you would go to Tartarus. But for 99.9% of Greeks, it was just going to be, you know, the walking around as shades. It was kind of the same, you know, was it Fields of Asphodel? It's the same fate. So they didn't fear the afterlife. They knew what it was, and there was kind of no getting around it. So a vulture wouldn't necessarily be scary to them. And I love that. I think that's such a powerful metaphor. And again, great little bit of transition here, because we go mom to mom. We go Hippolyta.
But wait, before we go to here's my next secret question for you.
All right.
So given Diana's journey here and Hippolyta, more importantly, Hippolyta's Orphician descent into the underworld here, what's another similar story like this that you've enjoyed?
Oh.
Whether it be comic books or you know, other media.
That's such a good question. So Orpheus and Eurydice is my favorite myth. I love it. I am so moved by it. When I was still in the classroom, there was a really amazing book of modern poetry inspired by that myth. And we would read the myth, and then we would read these sort of modern poems based on it. And then I don't know, did you see the Netflix show Chaos? It was K-A-O-S.
I have not seen that yet.
And I'm going to tell you not to, because in typical Netflix fashion, they canceled it after one season.
Oh, I think I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was brilliant. And Jeff Goldblum was Zeus. It was all centered on multiple myths, but Orpheus and Eurydice were like the heart of it. And when they canceled it, I was devastated because it was such a good show. Hmm. So I love this myth and I love this story. And I do love that, you know, Joseph Campbell-esque, the hero has to go into the depths of hell and come out, you know, in order to complete their journey. And so I love a good, you know, depths of hell moment. And so I think I've got probably an unusual example. I'm going to go out of comics, actually. And this is a movie, I don't know that it's fondly remembered. I really loved it, but maybe that was just me. Do you remember the movie What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams?
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, and so it's this... I remember it for the colors, especially. It was this beautifully shot movie. But in particular, he's married, I think it's not Isabella Rossellini. I'm going to have to check and see who it is. But he's married, and he and his wife have two kids. And the two kids die in an accident. And the couple's fracturing and basically are going to divorce because it's, you know, I mean, it'd be incredibly hard for a couple to survive the death of their children. And they recommit to each other. And it's like, okay, oh, it's Marie Nielsen. It's Annabelle Sciorra. That's why I was thinking. Okay. Isabella Rossellini and Annabelle Sciorra in my mind were two hot Italians from the same era. So, which would be a great name for a restaurant. So, two hot Italians, man, that would be a great name. So they're going to decide whether to live, you know, to divorce or to stay together. They stay together. They're, you know, healing. They're making it through. And then he dies and she's left alone. And he awakens in heaven, basically, in paradise. And it's this beautiful, I mean, again, the visuals of it, these oranges and greens, and like just very beautiful thing. But he learns at a certain point that his wife killed herself out of sadness. And she is down in sort of the depths of, now, I don't say hell necessarily religiously. It's almost a hell of her own making.
Right.
She's in her own despair, even in the afterlife. And his kids actually come to him, the spirit of his kids, and tell him, and he goes on this journey to free her. And I remember the visual because it's this dark gray and she's like chained to like the floor. It's this beautifully powerful visual of the power of depression. And he's able to go and sort of rescue her. And that movie is such a striking testament. I mean, it's, you know, look, is it corny at times? Yes. Is it saccharine? Yes, but I don't care. It is this beautiful testament to the power of love, right? To extend even beyond the span of life. And then I've always been really moved by that movie. I watched it when Robin Williams passed away, especially, you know, the way he passed away, it was even more resonant. And so that's the one I think of. This is a great question. What about you?
Oh, wow. Sean, that's a great choice. In fact, I think maybe even I was not consciously thinking of it, but maybe channeling that scene with Robin Williams' wife in the movie when I was thinking about the Pillar of Pallor.
Yeah, that's a great name, by the way.
yeah, that's such a good movie. I have to go watch that again. But my choice was, and this is another, I'm going back to comics for this one, but, you know, a character literally going to hell, not in the same sense as what Diana or what Hippolyta's doing here, well, I guess Diana too, but immediately, and given how much I know you are a Sandman fan, as am I, you know, Morpheus going to hell to retrieve his,
the helm.
Yeah,
great,
but just
choice.
That was just a wonderful story, and you know, it has ties to Orpheus, who is Morpheus's son in that world. So yeah, that was my choice.
That's a great choice. You know, it's funny. I'll tell you, I bought that. So I had missed Sandman. I didn't pick it up when it first came out, and luckily I went to a comic book store and I knew the woman who ran it. She wasn't the owner, but she ran it. I knew her really well because it was a small store, and I was one of, you know, like, I was a really frequent customer. I was in high school, and I would go in, and I didn't have a car, so I had to walk to the store, and the store was probably 4 to 5 miles away from my house. So it was like a thing, right? Like, I would walk there, and I wasn't just going to walk there, get comics, and go back. I would hang in the store for a while, especially because it wasn't very busy, and she and I would talk. She was a really nice person, and at one point, she got to know my tastes. And at one point, she kept telling me, like, are you reading? You got to buy this Sandman book. You'd really like it. And I was like, the art kind of bugs me. And I don't know. And I don't know the creators. And like, Sandman, really? Like, I remember from JLA Annual 1. She's like, no, it's a different character. And I'm like, well, I don't know. And finally, she puts issue 8 in my hands, the Sound of Her Wings, the very famous. Yeah. She's like, right now, read it in the store. And I read it and I go, oh my God, this is the best thing. And she's like, right. And I go, well, no, I've missed the first. And she goes, and she pulls the first 7 issues out from my box, you know. And she goes, no, I saved them for you. I knew eventually you'd come around. And I was like, oh my God. And so, like, you know, talk about best comic book store employee of all time. So I buy all of them immediately and read them. And it was when I got to that, I think it's issue 4 when he goes to hell to get his helm back. It was that challenge he has with the demon and that moment when he says, I am hope. And what is hell without a hope? And he defeats that back and forth with, like, I am this, where I went, oh, this is what brilliance looks like. Like, and, you know, and look, I'm never meet your hero. Like, you know, we look at Neil Gaiman very differently today than we did back then, but I'm going to separate the art from the artist. And that was, you know, a moment where I was like, oh, this is going to be one of the great comics of all time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, going back and getting back to that issue 8 again. So that's a great choice. And then even the storyline where Lucifer abandons hell, you know, down the road a little bit. So, man, great question. That's such a good question.
And just so before we move on, too, I just want to say, since we're talking about the story of Orpheus and how do you pronounce it? Eurydice?
Eurydice, uh-huh.
Yeah. Is that how it's supposed to be pronounced? Because I've pronounced it wrong all this time, if so.
No, I've heard it as Eurydice, and then the C in ancient Greece can have a ch sound in ancient Greek. So I've heard Eurydice, which I've never felt comfortable with. How did you pronounce it? Because I might be wrong.
Eurydice is how I pronounce it. I'm sure I'm wrong about that.
Oh, no, but I've heard that too. Yeah, I've heard all. Yeah, it's fine. We know what we mean.
Okay. But if you've not seen this Broadway show, Hadestown.
Yeah.
Great. I highly recommend it for anybody who's a fan, well, of good musicals, but you know, if you like stories about Greek mythology and this story in particular, and hope, it's such a powerful presence in that production. I've seen it twice now, once in New York, and then once in the traveling Broadway version of it, mm-hmm. more locally. And every time it brings tears to my eyes. It's such a wonderful production. So anyway, that's my recommendation for everybody.
I love that soundtrack. And my in-laws live in New York and we go back and visit them. And so we always try to do like a Broadway show. And my wife and my daughter went back to visit my in-laws over spring break last year. And I couldn't go because of a work commitment. And the show they chose to go to was Hadestown, and I still haven't forgiven them. I'm like, you know, that is my favorite myth. You know, I love that soundtrack, and you guys saw it without me. So anyway, there's a standing promise for my family that the minute it tours here, we're going.
Good.
So we cut back to, again, mom to mom. We cut back from Hippolyta to Diana, and now we're going to finish her origin. And so this is the part. This is so interesting to me because, in a way. And I'll talk about it after, but Perez and Ween sort of rushed this part, I believe, a little bit, because Diana wakes up on Paradise Island and she sees these energies coming from sort of the hell mouth, and she hears these sounds of battles, grabs her gun, runs over, sees characters we know, you know, Philippus and characters we know are still alive, fighting Codus, the hundred-handed one, is breaking out. And they're battling him and they're trying to shut the door and they're losing badly. And in runs Diana Trevor. She doesn't know these women. She has no idea what's happening. This is a paradigm shift in her universe. But she's a brave woman. She fires her gun. They're able to drive the hundred-handed one back. But he grabs one of the Amazons and pulls her in with him. And Philippus charges in. Diana charges in too. They're being overwhelmed by the hundred-handed one. But then Diana sees his glowing red eyes. Fires one more shot. Things kind of go bright. And we learn that she defeated him, at least momentarily, and saved the Amazons that were there, but pays with that with her life. And so I really feel like this whole piece could have breathed more. Like not in the storytelling. The storytelling is compact, concise, and really effective. But I wouldn't have minded a thought bubble or two, or a, you know, description or two in the panels saying something like, I got to Paradise Island. The Amazons took me in. I had no way home. They befriended me. Then this thing attacked and I helped defend. Or I helped defend. I ran in because I'm brave. I was wounded and the Amazons cared for me, but you know, for months, but I didn't make it. But at least I got to know them and they knew my story. Because for as much weight as is placed on her legacy to the Amazons, her name and everything, she's only with them for like seconds, basically. Mm-hmm. So what was your reaction? Did you have a similar reaction or what did you think?
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with you. That former option where, you know, she spends some time with them, mm-hmm. and they get to know each other. And that's why they appreciate and value her sacrifice later when it does happen.
Right.
Right. And that's why they chose, you know, what we're going to find out here in just a second, I'm sure, why Hippolyta chose what they chose in terms of her daughter becoming Wonder Woman later. So, yeah, I agree with you that I felt like that was not as well earned.
Yeah.
In terms of the legacy of Diana Trevor. It doesn't that I'm you know I don't want to insinuate that that somehow takes away her sacrifice and her bravery, because she what she does, like you said, you know, a paradigm shift. You know, you see this, and she doesn't freeze. You know, yeah. she just charges in because she sees people in peril and she has to help.
And it speaks to her. Like I feel like I know her character well mm-hmm. by the end of this, but I don't feel like the Amazons do. And so for the Amazons to place so much weight on her, and there's even yeah. a moment in the issue where she says to Diana, I'm going to explain to you the reason why your mother and the other Amazons never spoke to you about me and kept me secret. I still don't understand why they did. Like it, like I really even upon finishing the issue, I'm like, there was no reason for them not to tell this story. Like there just wasn't. And it actually to say to Diana, our Diana, hey, yeah, we named you this. Well, one, you know, there's the goddess of the hunt, Diana, but we've named you this because of this brave woman who we never knew, who charged in and saved many of our lives and maybe even the world if the hundred-handed one had gotten out. And you're named after her, and this is the stars. These stars are her banner, and you know, and there's just no reason not to tell the story. So I read along with the show, so I'm not reading ahead. So I'm hoping there's a little more explanation of that, because that feels a little strange. But overwhelmingly now, we have a massive post-crisis change in the paradigm of this book, because pre-crisis, Steve Trevor is Wonder Woman's love interest. He's the Lois Lane to her Clark Kent. You know, she's always rescuing him. And then in the 50s, when things get crazy sexist, he's rescuing her. And then, you know, flips back and forth. And volume one of this book I covered with Dr. Ange in the second episode ends with the two of them marrying and having sex, actually. Like, that's explicitly on the page. And so he has always been her dominant love interest. And Perez and Ween take this – and Potter take this big swing of aging him out of that, making him more of a mentor figure. And now they cement why he's in the book. And I like this, because if you stop and think of it from a post-crisis lens, there's no reason why Steve Trevor's in this book. Yes, he's older and he's a mentor, but why him? It's only out of a little tip of the cap to who he was in pre-crisis. And now they tighten that up and they go, no, it's way more than that. The Wonder Woman's literally named after his mom. Like their families, their legacies are tied together. So that's a big paradigm shift. What do you think of this addition to the mythos?
So I obviously because of the Wonder Woman television show, I knew who Steve Trevor was. Mm-hmm. I knew the relationship, the romantic relationship that they hinted at on the show. But I, beyond that, I didn't have much of a vested interest in them as a couple. Mm-hmm. And so when I get to this, and like you say, he's aged up, it's less of a romantic relationship, but more just a connection of some sort. And this is, we find out why here. I like that change, yeah. Actually. I thought it makes her different from Superman and Lois Lane. Mm-hmm. Does every superhero need a romantic interest, someone who's pursuing them and trying to get them to settle down or find out their secret identity or, you know, whatever. I feel like Diana is kind of, I want to say she's kind of above that kind of stuff, but yeah. I mean, she's not,
this
you know,
version,
she's,
yeah.
Or at least this depiction at this time. Right. But
yeah.
So she doesn't need that. She has more important things to do, you know, maybe down the road, you know, that's something that could be explored. But I didn't oppose Diana having some sort of relationship with someone. It didn't need to be Steve Trevor, though.
Yeah.
And maybe part of my reaction to that, to Steve Trevor in particular, is the way that he was portrayed.
Oh, on Lyle the TV Wagner. Show. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, Lyle Wagner is many things. A deeply passionate, you know, and romantic man is not one of them. I don't think his ability to play that is he's better on Carol Burnett's show than he is as a romantic lead. So mm-hmm. yeah, I feel the same way, and I think similarly because I didn't have the ties to Steve pre-crisis. This is the Steve I met and knew really well for the first time, and so I was like, oh, yep, that makes sense. I've said this on the show before, but in New 52 and Rebirth and whatever you want to call it, just modern DC. He is back as her love interest, and mm-hmm. I like that a lot because they write him
yeah.
really effectively. Like, he's a badass. He could lead his own comic. He's really great on his own, but he is ride or die for her, and they have a really fun relationship that is fun and sexual and modern. And so I like the modern take on it, but it was a big swing, and it's interesting. And Hades shows up at this moment looking very much like Joaquin Phoenix from Gladiator. Very
common. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, wow. If this had come out after Gladiator, I would have been like, oh, you swiped this. And also just wearing a skirt so short that his mom would blush. I mean, it's just it's a sartorial choice. Mm-hmm. And he kind of finishes the story saying that's why the Amazons took the stars banner. That's why they had the gun, the flashing thunder from issue one. And then in what I think is the most beautiful moment in the issue, Diana, this is all happening. You know, Steve's dad has passed, and you're kind of like, why the whole Steve dad passing? Maybe it was just to get us to the picture of his mom, but that's a long walk for that. And then you get to the payoff, which is Steve. This is all happening now because Steve's dad passed. He's about to go to his afterlife, and Diana Trevor is going to go join him. Like, she's basically been in this sort of not nether realm, but like interstitial afterlife, in order to, one, give Diana this knowledge, and then two, get the reward of going and meeting her great love in an afterlife, a very Jack and Rose, you know, from Titanic, except without completely disavowing her current husband, who she'd been married to for whatever how many years. I still struggle with that element of that movie. But but it's really beautiful. And Steve even says to Ed at his dad's funeral, my mom had appeared to me after she died saying she'd always watch over me. Now I feel like they both are. So how did you feel about that ribbon on the end of this?
I loved it. I thought it was a great way to tie the loose ends of these characters together. And then also, it's reflective of, you know, familial love, I'll just say.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have that love of Steve Trevor's parents. They get to join together. And we also will get, or we're getting, I should say, we're getting that tie between Hippolyta and Diana, that love that the mother has for her daughter in the way that she's pursuing Diana and trying to help her with this challenge. And so it doesn't quite come together in this issue, but, you know, it's working its way towards that, I believe. Yeah. And it's just a nice way to, even though what I have a problem with is poor Diana Trevor has been waiting.
Yeah.
How long to do this?
I'm going to apply afterlife rules for time and say like, you know, for her, it was a blink of an eye. I mean, it's not. She says, like, I've been waiting for this moment a long time. You know, her Hades, let's speed this up. But no, I agree. But I do love, and this is just something I love about this run, which is the strange moments where Perez and Ween just choose to live in for a minute, choose to take their time. Like, they don't need to do this whole moment. This doesn't need to happen. And in a different comic, it wouldn't. But Perez and Ween always lean into the emotional moment. They always lean into, we're going to give one extra page to wrap a bow on this really wonderful little love story of Steve Trevor's parents, who you're never going to hear from again. Never, you know, like they're not a big part of this book moving forward. It's just this, but it's so lovely. Yeah. And it's really heartwarming. And that is something, when people asked me why I started this show, the word I kept coming back to was lovely. I'm like, they're just lovely moments in this book that I remember to this day. And this is one of them, because I thought it was such a strong testament. Steve is this incredibly well-adjusted man, even though his mom passed early in his life. He had a great relationship with his dad, who raised him as a single dad. His mom loved him even after, you know, even from the afterlife. It's just all kind of loving and sweet upon loving and sweet. And that's what this book is, right? This book is all about the power of love and compassion. And so I like that they took that time. It really meant, you know, I was like, yeah, that's my favorite part of this issue. And then we transition to what is, in my mind, the least successful part of this issue. And this isn't on George and Len.
This is
on Steve Englehart, Joe Staten, and DC Editorial. Because they have got to get Diana to Millennium Number One, which is a horrible timing because she's still in the Hellmouth. She's flying through the darkness, and then Pan appears. And Diana naturally thinks, oh, you're a god. You must be here as part of the challenge, or you're directing me somewhere. And he's like, yep, I am. I'm directing you. And he almost looks at the camera and winks. He almost like, I'm directing you and you, readers, to Millennium Number One. And he puts her through this portal tells her briefly about the Manhunters, and Diana's like, yep, I'm fully committed to this thing I don't know or understand and a storyline I'm not part of. And yeah, and I will tell you, dear listeners, this is how much I love you and this show. I went and read Millennium number one just to make sure I wasn't missing anything. And I'm not. And I do not recommend that you read it. It literally just tacks the same panel of Pan pointing and Diana flying onto the end of Millennium one. And so though I needed to salvage something from this unbelievably clunky moment. So Eric, I have a secret question for you.
Oh boy.
So in this issue, Pan interrupts the challenge of the gods just so clumsily that it's almost embarrassing to send Diana to the Millennium crossover. It's this forced needle scratch in the middle of the story. And so in your opinion, what is the worst and what is a best or a really good example of a main character in their own book getting forcibly involved in a company-wide crossover? And I can go first if you want a little time.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So this is a tough one, right? This is every company-wide crossover, you've got a line of people in their own books, Superman, Batman, Starman, whatever, and you've got to somehow get them to the crossover. So for me, I had a couple of worsts. One from DC, and it's the Sinestro Corps War. And it is – I love Sinestro Corps War. I think that's a real high point in the Green Lantern mythos. It's a, you know, Jeff Johns. It's you know, really well done. But there is a moment in it, the Sinestro Corps War special, where they, at the last page, reveal the members of the Sinestro Corps. And one of them is the Anti-Monitor. And I'm like, what? I'm like, wait, what? Like, he was the main villain in Crisis. He dies in Crisis. He's kind of a sacred cow. Like, you don't go back to him. And you certainly don't make him a lackey of another villain. So not yeah. quite a true answer to my question, but it pissed me off enough I'm going to mention it. And then another one is somehow getting – so when Secret Wars 2 hit, and I'm not saying this as a brag but as an admission of my problem, my addiction to comics, Greg Aruge and I are the Secret Wars 2 experts on the planet. We covered that book, every painstaking issue, though the crossovers are the best thing ever. And in Secret Wars 2, the first two issues, the Beyonder comes to the Earth as a sort of energy creature. So there's really nothing happening. There's nothing for him to do, but they have to somehow get him crossing over with books right away, just like is happening here. So they have him appear in Manhattan and just randomly turn an entire skyscraper to gold. Just like, it's so random. It makes no sense in the story. Somebody sort of wishes for money, and so this building becomes gold. And it takes over two issues of Spider-Man, one of Amazing, one of Peter Parker or Webb. I don't remember the other one. But anyway, it is the most pointless crossover ever. This building is just turned to gold. It brings Spider-Man into Secret Wars 2. They try to, you know, I think it's Peter David, tries his best to make it a worthwhile thing by having Spider-Man take a gold notebook that was in a trash can in the building and think to himself, oh, I could sell this, get some money for rent. But then he has a whole guilt trip about it, which is incredibly stupid because it's not like he stole something from somebody. It was in the garbage. And, you know, but anyway, really, really bad. And then, of course, leads down the road in the crossover to the moment where he teaches the Beyonder how to poop. So,
oh my God.
That's my worst. Yeah. I mean, just horrible. And then my best.
I remember that. I remember that too.
Yes.
And it's just like that was really funny, but, you know, also very juvenile.
Jim Shooter, may he rest in peace, legend of the industry, wrote some of my favorite comic books ever. Secret Wars 2, literally the chronicle of his middle age breakdown, and I still have shivers from having covered that series. In my mind, one of the better examples of this was actually in DC Rebirth Special 1. DC had rebooted everything with New 52 after Flashpoint. It was not done particularly well because Batman didn't really have interruptions. Green Lantern didn't have interruptions, but then some other things were wholly different. And it was missing the heart of the universe, which was Wally West, Tim Drake, some of the great legacy characters. And so Rebirth corrects that by having Wally have been trapped in the time stream. And by, well, later we find out about Dr. Manhattan, which is not great. But anyway, being trapped in the time stream and then coming out when Barry remembers him. So a really good way to get Wally involved in this line-wide soft reboot of Rebirth. So, okay, so what about you? Any bad examples or good examples?
Oh, boy. So when you said the first thing you were talking about where you hated that thing, that prompted me. I don't know if this actually answers the question precisely, but as far as something that I don't like or is the worst example. Oh, yeah. the revelation of Hawk as being Monarch.
Oh, good one. Yes.
Because that pissed me off.
Yes.
Big time. Because I was a huge fan of the series Hawk and Dove.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the issue. Was it 20-something, 30-something? I don't remember how far it went. But, you know, it's just, Armageddon 2001 is going on. Who's Monarch and all this stuff? And I honestly did not know about the change in direction until years later.
Oh, yeah,
so
me too.
To me, it was just like, well, okay, which character is it? All this stuff. And then when you get, and I don't remember if it was actually revealed in the Armageddon 2001 comic or if it was in the Hawk and Dove issue now, but the story's going along in Hawk and Dove, and all of a sudden, Future Hawk shows up and kills Dove.
Yeah, no, it's Armageddon 2001. It's in the actual. It's a 2-part story with a bunch of annuals in between. But it's issue 2. He just randomly murders Don Granger, which was, for people who loved Hawk and Dove, was shocking and horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, it was horrible in many ways. And I'll take that I'll put that forth as the worst.
Yeah.
Oh, all these years later, it's now almost 25 years later, right? And I'm still pissed about it. Let's see. For a good one, well, the first thing that came to mind, unfortunately, and maybe because your previous guest mentioned it, but Laurel Kent, that would have been I don't know if I should get into this, but only because how Levitz deals with the character in the Legion of Superheroes, not how she's portrayed in Millennium. So, but I guess another one that I could maybe answers this question for you is because a few years ago I read through 52.
Oh, nice.
And was posting about it on my website.
Uh-huh.
And I was really, and that was the first time I'd read 52 since it had been first published. And what I really appreciated about the story this time was Elongated Man's journey in that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't think that quite answers your question, but I'll still put that forth.
No, look, it's a weird question, but it's malleable. No, it's worth it alone because 52 is brilliant, and the Rene, the question arc and the Rene Montoya arc.
Oh, that's
is
a good one too. Yeah, I could have chosen that one.
Favorite arcs ever. The Elongated Man arc. I mean, talk about kind of tying back to that. What Dreams May Come. Talk about the power of love. Mm-hmm. You know, that arc is so beautiful, and I mean that whole book is just. Is so underrated. It's really phenomenal. So Pan very clunkily drop kicks Diana to Millennium number one, where she does nothing. She literally does nothing. And it was a totally ridiculous, poor George, poor Len. But you know, it's part and parcel of writing a monthly book at DC or Marvel. But they salvage it because instead of making that the cliffhanger for the issue, we cut back to Hippolyta. And this time she's attacked by a bunch of Betty Rosses, a bunch of harpies. And I mean, she's technically the harpy. And
I'm sorry, I only knew this recently because I was reading what she appears in Immortal Hulk, I think
yes,
it was.
Yeah, she
as
reverts
a harpy?
Back to the harpy. Yeah, this was a Bronze Age thing in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah, she was transformed, I think, in a gamma accident. She becomes the harpy, and then Al Ewing picked up on it in Immortal Hulk.
Oh, okay. And, yeah. Okay. I thought it was a new thing. So,
No. It was a way Bronze Age thing. So a bunch of harpies attack. She's fighting them. She's kind of knocked off a precipice. She, digs her axe into the stone as she's falling, and she hears a scream. And we the camera pulls back, and we can see that the stone is this enlarged statue of a man screaming. And she recognizes the voice, and it's Heracles, the man who accosted her in the Amazons in issue one. So Paris and Ween are not satisfied tying up some mysteries or stories from issue one. They're going for all of them. I mean, it's really, what were your thoughts on this cliffhanger?
I mean, she's literally hanging.
Yeah, literally a cliffhanger. Yes.
on Heracles' stony arm there. I thought this was brilliant, bringing Heracles into this and in a way that is just so unexpected for that brash,
horrible misogynist.
Thank you. Yeah, I was trying to think of the right terrible terms to use for him. And he's obviously in pain. He's screaming, mm-hmm. and it's Hippolyta with him. And so it's like, oh my God, I have to read the next issue.
Well, and also the brilliance of the storytelling of the MacGuffin of this arc is the sexually predatory nature of Zeus. So to now have the other example of a sexual predator from this comic come in this diminished state where the power dynamic is reversed is fascinating. And again, just such good storytelling. Like all of us, I think of Perez, you know, artist first, you know, storyteller, but artist first. And I forget, you know, and obviously Len Wein's with him, but I forget what a great writer he is. Like, this is such tight writing, especially considering this is his first ongoing, right? This is the first book he's really leading in this manner. So just an amazing, amazing ending to the story. And, you know, leaves us definitely wanting more. The issue itself is beautiful. Perez does the layouts, Patterson does the finishes. I think it's more successful than it was in the previous issue where that same paradise existed. I think Patterson's got a better hang of it. But do you have a favorite panel from the art?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it was hard to choose.
Yeah.
But I talked to more at the top of the show about the transitions. Having liked the transitions in this, and not only from a narrative standpoint, but also a visual one. And this is the first panel, the top panel on page 14, where Diana Trevor is again recounting her arrival at Paradise Island, and she's her profile is on the left of the panel. And as you transition to the right of this page-wide panel, it turns into the rolling waves of the past as we see her on the beach. And I just thought, that is just a great way to show a past occurrence, you know, because in television, especially on like soap operas and stuff, or sitcoms, we would see like that wavy line that goes down the television or across the television screen or whatever. And this is such a better way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that comics can do that you can't do in other media. Right. It's a simple moment, but it really, I think, encapsulates this whole idea of, the theme of the issue of revelations and why this person is the way she is and what does that mean for Diana. And I just think it's a really lovely construction.
Yeah, and it's so great. You've done such a good job of really highlighting the power of this issue with those transitions and the tight storytelling. And I do think that this is like a textbook example. If I were teaching a comic book writing class, I would use this issue as like, hey, textbook example of great editing, of great cuts, using great cuts to propel the story forward, the theme of the story forward, without drawing a big arrow pointing, you know, look at this, right? Like it's so well done. I went a much less intellectual place, and I just really loved at the top of page 14. We talked about it, panel where Hippolyta hacks the skull zombie's head off, and it goes flying at the reader almost in 3D. And you could almost hear it yelling in like Gilbert Gottfried's voice, right? It's just it's such a fun, goofy panel. And it's purposely goofy. Like, you know, Perez and Patterson, maybe it was Patterson who added it in. You know, both of them were kind of chuckling at like, oh, okay, this is really funny. I love it. I think it's such an awesome moment. It shows what a badass Hippolyta is, but it also is a little tongue-in-cheek, which is always good.
So. Yeah, yeah. And I meant to ask you, when you were talking about this before, when you mentioned Army of Darkness, when did that movie come out?
Oh, God, it was like early 90s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there's no way that this was...
No. It may have been influenced by Evil Dead. I'd have to look at when Evil Dead came out.
Okay.
But no, Army of Darkness is well after this book. Yeah.
Because there's also a point somewhere in here where I think it's Hippolyta mentioned something about ash on the ground. I can't find it right now, but I thought, wait a minute, ash, the visual cue to Army of Darkness or Evil Dead or whatever. It's just like, wait a minute.
So Evil Dead 1 and 2 had come out by the time this
came out.
So definitely, I mean, maybe Perez and Wien were fans, which would, I mean, were Bruce Campbell fans.
That's what I'm wondering, yeah.
Would make me so happy. I mean, that would make me so unbelievably happy. The other, I think, visual reference to it, and this might be where they're having fun, is the Harry Hamlin Clash of the Titans. You know, the claymation fights, the fights that, you know, the, I forget what it's called, but like the Kraken and the way they had to depict those moments and some of those early like Hercules movies from the 60s and 70s with the like stop motion clay monsters. And so I think maybe there's a little bit of that going on too, but it's just such a fun panel. So Eric, this brings us to the end of the issue, but not quite the end of the episode. Because
before we get there, I have one more secret question for you.
Oh, good. Bring it.
So since we've reached the end of the issue, we have the revelation of Diana Trevor being the inspiration for Diana, or at least in name and also in
spirit, kind of. Yeah,
But in terms of the clothing, you know, and all that kind of stuff, right?
Oh yeah, the armor she gets, band, the standard that she carries.
Uh-huh. The standard. Thank you. Yes, exactly. So what's another secret revelation about an established character that you like or don't? Either one.
Oh, that's such a good question. I try to keep this positive, this show positive. I'm going to open on a negative, only because I hate it so much. It's the retconning of Barry Allen's origin that Reverse Flash went back in time and murdered his mom and framed his dad. And that's sort of the impetus for him becoming a hero. I get it. And it's well done in the Flash TV show, the CW show. I get why Geoff Johns did that. I get why it adds this compelling narrative to Barry that maybe wasn't there before for some folks. It makes him too Batman for me. It's too much, too close to a Batman origin for me. But one of the things I always loved about plain old milquetoast bowtie Barry Allen was that he got powers and was like, yep, I'm going to become a hero because I loved comic books.
Yeah.
I loved The Flash. He named himself The Flash because he used to read about Jay Garrick's adventures in comic books. And I always really liked that. It's one of the things I love about Will Payton, the Starman character, and just other characters. You see it more in DC than in Marvel. But characters who are like, oh, I've gained power. I'm going to do the right thing with it because it's the right thing to do, not because of some great tragedy that's haunting me. So that's a example of you know, I didn't like. An example of a retcon that I did like is I do, and this is controversial. I love the revelation that Parallax had infested Hal Jordan.
That's a good one.
And that's why the whole Emerald Twilight thing happened. I am not by nature a Hal Jordan fan. I think Kyle Rayner's the best Green Lantern. If you're gonna do a Green Lantern book, Kyle's my first choice, John's my second, Guy's my third, the Diamond Guy is fourth, the Bird Tomar Ray's fifth. Like Hal Jordan, Mogo is sixth. I mean, Hal Jordan's pretty far down the list for me, but Emerald Twilight was just character assassination, and it was such a quick turn. Especially because the issue before it, he comes to grips with Coast City having been destroyed, and then there's this hard turn that I thought the Parallax invading him was really elegant. And I know a lot of people don't like this, but I love the visual cue of it, of that's why he got graying temples.
Right.
And so anyway, I like that one. What about you?
Well, I'll for something I don't like, I'll refer you to my previous answer about Hawk.
Oh, yeah.
Still pissed.
Yes.
But something I like, this is something I read in Moore's, was it Moore at that point or the other guy? But Miracle Man.
Oh.
Where you find out, where it's revealed to him and to us that all of the adventures of Miracle Man, formerly Marvel Man, were actually a VR experience by his nemesis.
That's awesome. That's Moore. That's really early. That's in the first few issues of the reboot. So yeah, that's more. That's awesome. That's such a good. I mean, it's basically like C.C. Beck saying all the Captain Marvel Fawcett issues comics, all mind manipulation. You know, that's phenomenal. That's a great choice. Oh, good ending secret question. So now that we've closed out the issue, we always close every episode with a segment that I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, because that is Diana's ultimate goal. And in this segment, the guests and I each take a little bit of time to talk about a way, either silly or serious, that we would bring peace to man's world. So mine is going to be a little bit silly. I am what they called in the 80s husky, maybe portly. I definitely, you know, when my mom bought me jeans when I was in elementary school, they had the word husky on the tag, which I didn't love.
Oh my, I remember that. Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of fat shaming.
Wow.
So I've always been somebody who is wrestling with his weight, less wrestling, more just giving in to the foods I love, but you know, still. And so Eating right. Yeah, eating right has always been a challenge. So I feel like it's 2025, almost 2026. We have evolved enough scientifically that we should be able to make health food taste like the bad food that many of us are addicted to. There is no reason why tofu tastes like tofu, which is nothing. Tofu should taste like Twinkies. Like tofu should taste like Fruity Pebbles. Tofu should taste like a really good burger. And then I would devour health food, and I would be a much healthier man. Now, I realize the pushback to this is you're a grown man. You should have self-control. You should make these choices on your own. You are more than equipped to eat healthy. There are more than enough options for you. And I say to all those things, no. I say to all of them, don't put expectations on me. Don't ask me to be in control of my own life. Stop referring to me as a grown man. I throw off the yoke of maturity, and I say, make it easy for me. Make healthy foods taste like bad foods, and I'll be thinner. So that's my peace to man's world. What about you?
That is amazing. considering just recently, so I don't know, since you mentioned Twinkies, Sean, one of the Hostess dietary bombs, a favorite of mine are Suzy Q's. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, so good. Yes, yes.
Right?
Suzy and I have had a long-standing relationship. She might be my longest relationship.
The problem I have where I live is that no place carries Suzy Q's.
That's interesting.
We have Twinkies and Ding Dongs and the cupcake ones, whatever those are called, in abundance, but no Suzy Q's. But this is good timing because 2 days ago, I found that one of the stores here had a few boxes of Suzy Q's. And I'm currently on a diet and trying to lose some weight. And I find these, I'm like, this is so bad, but I bought a couple.
You had to. I mean, look, it's a scarcity thing. You know, that wasn't not having the willpower. That was you saying anything else I'd say no to, but these are
exactly. Yeah.
So I don't know if you know this, the Suzy Q's are based on Whoopie pies. Okay, so I did not know this. I'm from the West. We do not have Whoopie pie. Whoopie has a different meaning out here. We and we certainly wouldn't put those two words together. I'd never heard of Whoopie pies. And then I worked with a woman who was from Maine, and she and I we chaperoned a bunch of stuff together, and we were good friends, and so we'd always sign up for chaperoning together when we were classroom teachers because it just made it more fun. And at one point, I had stopped to get snacks for the kids, like the student council kids, and I bought just a bunch of junk, and I had gotten Suzy Q's. And she's like, are these Whoopie pies? And I go, what did you just say? I go, they're Suzy Q's. And she's like, no, they're Whoopie pies. And I go, I don't even know what word you're saying right now. Those are Suzy Q's. It's like a chocolate cake with whipped cream in the middle. And she's like, yeah, it's an East Coast thing. These are Whoopie pies. And I'm like, you're making this up. There's no such thing as Whoopie pies. And so we had this long run, like multi-year back and forth, like joking about Whoopie pies and Suzy Q's. And so she was leaving the school and she was moving. And so it was her last week. And so we threw her a party to say goodbye. And I made this whole big show of how I went to all these different stores and bakeries in Arizona. And I tracked down a Whoopie pie for her as a special gift to say goodbye. And she like literally is tearing up. And I opened the box and I just had been a bunch of Hostess Suzy Q's in the box. And she was furious and then laughed. And it was like my favorite thing. So yeah, so fun little Suzy Q memory. But I interrupted. Great. Eric, how would you bring peace to man's world?
All right. Well, unfortunately, my initial thought was this is not a fun little thing. But
that's okay. They can be serious. They're good.
I'm not going with this, but I do want to say, you know, besides getting rid of old white men who are in leadership positions,
yes,
is unfortunately something that needs to happen these days. But and I have to say, when we talked about doing this episode together, and I was trying to figure out, okay, how would I bring peace to man's world? The first thing, besides what I just said, the second thing I thought of was something that you chose, like, I'll say 3 episodes ago. And I'm like, damn it, Sean.
Oh, I know. I feel bad because these are hard to come up with every month. And so I've had a couple people tell me like, oh, you totally stole the one I was going to use.
Yeah. So anyway, so I had to think a little bit more. And so this is the thing, and it's sort of like kind of the thing you said before, but I like this idea because it has a bit of a sci-fi bent to it. So I really think that we would have peace in our world if everyone just could walk in another person's shoes for some time. And what is a better sci-fi representation of that than Inner Light from Star Trek: The Next Generation?
Oh, great callback.
Right. So Picard has an encounter with an alien probe and he collapses. And then most of the episode is taken up by him living on this other planet mm-hmm. and experiencing life on that other planet until he dies. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody, you know, go through the pain of death in this, but I think it'd be really cool if we could come up with some device like the, what was it? Parvenium probe. Awesome. And I had to look that up.
That's awesome.
To see what it was. So you could live another's life in, you know, maybe 30 minutes or whatever time, but so that you get to know what it's like to be a human being in that from that person's point of view, so that you expand your own idea of what it is to be a human being and how to interact with other human beings. That's not just you're bad, you're good,
yeah,
you're okay, and you're not. Which I think is the dichotomy that we currently have in a lot of places in the United States. And besides the empathy that hopefully this would foster, you know, you might end up with side benefits like being able to play the Ruskin flute like Picard did.
Very nice. That is my dominant memory of that episode is Picard playing that flute. That is that's a great choice. And it actually ties really nicely back to the earlier questions where we were talking about how getting to know our parents, stories of, you know, before they were parents, right? Like even the ability to walk in each other's shoes in a way of different, you know, groups, different people from different countries, lands, cultures.
Exactly.
That's all so yeah. important. But even the ability to do that with your own parent, you know, or your own family and get to know their stories differently. That's a proper ending versus my silly whoopee cushion or whoopee pie idea. No, that's awesome. And you know what's really funny is I love doing the show for a million reasons, but I really love the Lasso of Truth moments because people just bring the best freaking stories. And it's a chance to get to know people in our podcasting community better and differently, but they're also just, I mean, sometimes really sad, sometimes laugh out loud funny. I mean, I love those stories. But the Bringing Peace to Man's World section, I feel like we are generating this wealth of great ideas. And so I'm really hoping that this is something that we can help manifest because it's telling of the times we live in that a lot of the ideas that are being brought are about empathy and caring and putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And I think it shows the inherent goodness of so many of us in this community, because I do think if you grow up reading comics, you do have a greater empathy in some ways because mm-hmm. you've lived all those different lives. You've been Superman and Lois and Jimmy and Perry and, you know, and all the, you know, Brainiac and Lex Luthor, and you've been all these different characters your whole life that you've read and loved, and it just does make you see the world a little differently. So great answer. So
totally agree with that. Yeah.
So thank you so much for being on this episode. This has been so much fun. I love that we are getting a chance to record together so quickly after I was a guest on your amazing show, one of my favorite podcasting experiences of all time. Maybe my favorite podcasting experience.
Aww,
of all time.
That's sweet of you.
And no,
thank you.
It was awesome. I was just riding a high of that episode for so long. But I want to tell listeners where they can find you. Again, you laughed at me early in the episode, but like, you know, you have been doing this longer than most, better than most, and I am a devotee of your shows. And so if for those who may not know, please tell listeners where they can find you.
All right. Well, again, Sean, thank you. This has been a delight. I've been looking forward to this chance to talk to you about Wonder Woman issue number 12 for literally months. and so I really appreciate the show and you, and it's just a lot of fun. But if people want to, for some reason, want to check me out, I do a podcast, Long Box Review, where I talk about mostly comic books, but I also have a few other things in the feed, such as The Gutters, where I talk about mm-hmm. me, which just seems like the ultimate in hubris, but But I also get to talk about things that are not part of the comic book side of things. I also we mentioned the Legion of Superheroes and the Legion Project earlier, and that's something I do with Peter Rios, where we talk about the Volume 3 Legion of Superheroes, the Baxter run. And sometimes, occasionally, I even talk about Star Trek on my Center Seat imprint. Not enough, but hopefully next year we'll change that. But regardless, you can find all of this at the website. It's longboxreview.com. I try to keep it simple as possible. So if people want to check that out and subscribe to the shows, let me know that you've done that because you heard me here on Sean's wonderful show. And I'd really appreciate that. So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here again. And it's so funny because I've told you this before and you poo-pooed me, but I've only been nervous maybe four times podcasting with folks. One was Peter, and I was like, oh my god, like he's like a legend. One was you. I'm loathe to say this. The first time I recorded with Shag, I was nervous because I had such admiration for him before I got to know him. You know, once I got to know him, you know, that's just all admiration goes up the door. But you know, there are these, and then Michael Bailey. Like there are these pillars of podcasting. Just people have been doing it for so long and so well, whose shows I've listened to, and you know, you develop this parasocial relationship where you're like, oh my god, I've like literally heard hundreds of hours of you talking, and so to have us then record together and have it be so wonderful, and you'd be such a wonderful person, and I feel like we, you know, have a great time when we're recording. It's just it's like the icing on the cake or on the whoopie pie, I guess. The icing in the whoopie pie. I'm gonna end this metaphor before I get in trouble. But thank you so much again, and listeners, we are gonna take a podcast promo break, and we will be back with your feedback covering issue 11 with my buddy Clinton Robison.
2 months only, Halloween Hoedown at the House of Frankenstein.
Your favorite Halloween party returns with four brand new episodes featuring cinematic horror classics and horror-filled superhero tales starring Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man.
Pin the bandage on Boris Karloff as the Mummy.
You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime. And death.
Do the locomotion with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing on the Horror Express.
Are you telling me that an ape that lived 2 million years ago got up to that crate, killed the baggage man, and put him in there?
Yes, I am. It's alive. It must be.
Bob for Apples with Hammer's The Reptile.
Get away from there! Get away! Shh!
Jam to the blues at this juke joint full of sinners.
We gonna kill every last one of you.
This September and October, join the Supermates at FireAndWaterPodcast.com for the most happening haunt this side of the mausoleum, the House of Frankenstein. Halloween Hoedown!
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback for Wonder Woman issue 11, which I covered with my buddy Clinton Robison. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at FireAndWaterPodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. Up first is one of my favorite people on the planet, the delightful Martin Gray, who wrote in to say, "Excellent show, Sean and Clinton. I remember Challenge of the Gods wasn't my favorite because I thought our heroine should be declaring war on those Olympian bullies, not running around proving herself to them." Good point, Martin. Still, this did have that mind-boggling final page, and the lighter art of Paris Patterson was very nice. Martin goes on to refer to my story that I told on the episode about my wife's 21st birthday coinciding with the death of Princess Diana, saying, "It's interesting about your wife being upset about people being upset about Princess Diana dying on her birthday, Sean. But I know exactly what she means. In the UK, it was ridiculous. People were weeping in the streets as if they had known her personally. Weirdly, the week the real-life Princess Diana died, we had Wonder Woman 126 declaring Diana, Princess of Themyscira, struck down." I did not know that that also coincided, Martin. That is astounding and fascinating. And like John Byrne, once again, predicting the future. Martin then goes on to discuss the appearance of a pre-Sandman Morpheus in the issue, saying, "As regards to the Olympian Morpheus not looking like the Neil Gaiman version, it's a shame George Perez didn't have a few years' advance notice of the idea that Morpheus was at this point in a cellar in England. He could have chosen Morpheus to be the Manhunter agent instead of Pan, and at the end of the story, the Olympians would have said, 'But where's the real Morpheus?' And that would have been left dangling, and everyone would marvel at the long-term planning when all was revealed."
Martin, that is genius. That is seriously brilliant, and I wish I had a time machine to go make that happen. Up next is previous guest Justin Steiner, who says, I really dug the page where it was just Diana in all white panels juxtaposed against the dangers. And yeah, that Morpheus bit threw me for a real loop. Super cool last page as well. Referring to my observation that the late 80s Starman series is set in my hometown, Justin says, hey Sean, when you're ready to start your Will Payton Starman show, I am all in. I love that idea. Aaron Head Moss already does a really great Will Payton Starman show. And so I think that's covered, but you know, I might get the itch at some point. Next up is network co-founder and film commentary guru Rob Kelly, who references my idea to bring peace to man's world by letting every person choose their own preferred voice for when they are on hold, for example, Jessica Rabbit. Rob says, I love the hold music idea. For some reason, still, in 2025, most hold music sounds like it is being played off a bootlegged cassette via a boombox held underwater. It's almost literally so difficult to listen to. And he says, I know that's the point. They want you to hang up. My choice of hold voice would be Bob Dylan, because his bizarre intonations would make such boring hold messages at least sound interesting. I can't even imagine Bob Dylan as the voice of of the hold person. I like he would be like, operators, and then nothing else would make sense, but it would be poetic and beautiful. Rob closes saying, great episode, even with Clinton. Oh, come on, Rob. Clinton's one of the good ones, which I know Rob knows. The amazing Dr. Ange then writes in to address the secret questions from the episode, saying, as to the question about a comic set in your home state, I live in Massachusetts, but consider myself a Rhode Islander. Love that the Happy Harbor JLA HQ was in the Ocean State. I think that's so cool. I love that they used it on Young Justice as well, Dr. Ange. He goes on to say, for my favorite armored look for a hero, I love the Thor answer because it was necessary for the story. I'm going to stretch it and say the Supermobile, his armor that allows Superman to continue to use his powers. I will allow it. Because the cover of Superman punching Amazo in the Supermobile is one of the all-time best Superman covers, and it's my favorite. Angie goes on to say, as for my favorite Millennium plot, also Laurel Kent. It obviously was a cash grab to put the Legion into the event, but it makes zero sense. She woke up 1,000 years later and maintained her mission? She allowed herself to be hurt by a K-bullet in the annual and got medical care, and no one knew she was a robot? But man, Grell knew how to draw her. Yeah, totally agree. Grell is the creator, co-creator, and she's beautiful. And then Giffen draws Legion Annual 1, where the Who Shot Laurel Kent Annual, and she's amazing. And then Greg LaRocque, you know, draws the two Millennium issue crossovers, and she's amazing there too, even in all her robotic destructive beauty. Ian Miller also writes in to address the secret questions from the episode, saying, in regards to the question about a comic set in your home state, when you were talking about the Oklahoma airport, it reminded me of the fantastic Christopher Priest Deathstroke run during Rebirth, when several scenes happened in Minnesota. As a Minneapolis native, that was a treat for me, especially when Deathstroke flies about the MSP International Airport. The artist definitely did his research on what the airport looks like from the top. I also like seeing the big cherry on the spoon sculpture in Tom King's Adam Strange miniseries, since Mr. Terrific apparently hangs out in Minneapolis in that book. Great, great message, Ian. I also love that Deathstroke run by Priest. It's my favorite Deathstroke run of all time. And I liked that a lot of it was set in Minneapolis because I had just visited there at the time for work. So very cool. Up next is Super Captain, who writes in with his thoughts on the episode Secret Questions, saying, speaking of stories set in our home states, my hometown is in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, quite close to the highest point east of the Mississippi. It's so small that the students of Sean's high school would have outnumbered the entire population. That's crazy, but I did have like 3,500 people in my high school. So I've never seen the area depicted in comics. In fact, the only time that I can recall a similar locale being portrayed in comics were the moments in The New Mutants when we saw Sam Guthrie's home in Kentucky. That's so cool, Super Captain. I think you're referring to New Mutants like 41 or 42 when Sam brings Lila Cheney home. And that is a favorite issue of mine. So great callback. Super Captain goes on to say, as for fictional mountains, the first that came to mind were the Lord of the Ring peaks mentioned in the podcast, but Challenger's Mountain was always a fun headquarters as well. I am so disappointed in myself, Super Captain, because Clinton brought this great secret question about your favorite mountain in fiction. And I went to Snake Mountain from He-Man. You know, obviously Lord of the Rings came up as well, but Challenger Mountain is far and away the best choice, and I'm so embarrassed that I did not think of it. Super Captain wraps up saying, as far as armored characters go, it's probably Alan Scott from Kingdom Come. And yes, Sean, I love Gruenwald's cap run, but the later issues where Steve is paralyzed and gets a suit of armor from Tony Stark are not the best. Yeah, I love Gruenwald. I'm never going to disparage him, but he stayed on cap, I don't know, a good 5 to 6 years too long. Network All-Star and host of Cheers cast, Ryan Daly, writes in to comment on the secret question about the best example of a return of a beloved character, saying, "As for the favorite return of a beloved character, this one is way outside sci-fi fantasy. During the first season of the TV series Sports Night, one of the show's main cast members, the great Robert Guillaume, suffered a stroke. Aaron Sorkin, the creator and writer of the show, worked that into the series so that Guillaume's character, Isaac, and managing editor of Sports Night, had a stroke and didn't appear on screen during the last 6 or 7 episodes. At the end of the season finale, when couples have broken up and everything seems to be going wrong and they can't even get a photo camera to work, Dana, played by the amazing and felonious, nice Ryan, Felicity Huffman, begs, 'I want something good to happen. One thing. Can I get a good thing to happen?' Cue a recognizable voice from off screen, 'Hey, lady,' and they pan over to Robert Guillaume as Isaac, standing there wondering if the staff is ever going to get back to work and make the TV show. It's such a beautifully set up moment and so powerfully realized because it's not just the heroic turn of a character, but the actor's first on-screen appearance, again, since nearly dying." That is an awesome example, Ryan. I really liked Sports Night. It was the first time I had heard of Sorkin. It was a really good show, short-lived, but really good show. And that is a great, great moment. Bucky749 writes in with his own secret question, which is always a lot of fun, asking, "Now my secret question, let's say Wonder Girl and Wonder Tot." Bucky, really, he's got a thing for Wonder Girl and Wonder Tot. It cracks me up. He says, "Let's say Wonder Girl and Wonder Tot watch the following cartoons: Gem and the Holograms, Dungeons and Dragons, and She-Ra. Which do you think they would like best?" Those are all three awesome cartoons. If we're talking new She-Ra, the one from like 5 years ago, then that is far and away the winner. That was one of the best cartoons ever. I watched that with my daughter. It's one of the best cartoon watching experiences I've ever had. So far and away the winner. Good question, Bucky. And bringing us home is David Ace Gutierrez, who writes to comment on my Lasso of Truth story about the revamped candid camera coming to my junior prom, saying, "Did Sean have a normal adolescence or childhood at all? Candid camera? So we could have seen Sean together with Alan Funt?" That is an awesome comment, Dag. I don't think the reboot was hosted by Alan Funt. It actually may have been hosted by Alan Funt Jr., which is a weird thing to say, but yeah, no, I had a very weird upbringing with a lot of weird misadventures, which is one of the reasons it's so much fun to do this show, because I get to share my silly stories with all of you. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, Eric, for being an amazing guest on this episode, and please join me next month to bring a little bit of peace to mankind.